no more clause. It stands for no more. Now we have a president that says, up yours to the Congress.
Don Young makes a move to block a federal plan that calls for more wilderness in Anwar. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, with hundreds of wildfires across Alaska, a look at whether the state will set a new record.
We are ahead of that pace right now, but I can tell you in July 2004, that was the big fire month.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
An icebreaker leased to Shell had to return to Dutch Harbor early Friday morning after its hull was found to have a rupture. The MV Fenica carries the company's capping stack, a critical piece of safety equipment for Shell's plan to drill two wells this summer in the Chukchi Sea. Coast Guard spokesman Sean Eggert says the ship's crew noticed the problem around 3 a.m.
The motor vessel Fenica was departing from the port of Dutch Harbor, Alaska, when the crew discovered that they had water coming into their port number 4 ballast tank. At that point, they returned to port and tied up at the Delta Western dock. Divers there discovered a 1-inch wide by 3-foot long fracture in the ship's hull.
Eggert says the Coast Guard is investigating the cause and will examine Shell's proposal to repair the ship. The spokesman says the marine pilot who maneuvered the ship out of port was still on board when the breach was discovered. Shell spokesman Luke Miller describes it as a small breach. He says the vessel was in charted waters at the time. Miller says it's unclear if the damage will delay Shell's plans for the already short Arctic drilling season.
At this point, it's too early to know. Inspections are ongoing. Repairs may be possible on site, but that's still being determined right now.
The Fenica has a draft of 27 feet. Miller says it's possible the ship struck something underwater.
Inspectors will reenact the Fenica's route to learn if a shallow hazard exists that has not been charted.
Shell did not issue any statement about the breach until an energy reporter for Houston Chronicle wrote about it 4 days after the fact. Miller says the company was waiting to verify the damage and find a solution, which was hampered by weather. Shell is still waiting for two key permits, the authorizations to drill the two wells. If the government gives the green light, it is requiring Shell to have the Fenica nearby with the capping stack ready to deploy within 24 hours of a blowout. The Fenica is a 380-foot Finnish-owned icebreaker. Shell is also leasing its sister ship, the Nordica, for ice management. Shell hasn't drilled in the Chukchi since the 2012 season, which was plagued with shipping and towing problems. Alaska Congressman Don Young this afternoon added an amendment to a bill that would block the feds from implementing a plan that calls for more wilderness in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. APRN's Liz Bruskin reports.
Young's amendment to the Interior Department spending bill passed the House by voice vote after a brief debate.
Questions on the amendment offered by the gentleman from Alaska. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. The amendment is agreed to.
President Obama announced the update to the comprehensive plan for the Arctic Refuge in January with great fanfare. The planning document calls for designating most of the refuge wilderness, the highest level of protection. The Alaska delegation to Congress and the governor hit the roof, and they've stayed mad. They, like a majority of Alaskans in many polls, want the coastal plain of the refuge opened to oil and gas exploration. Young says the president's actions are illegal because only Congress can declare a wilderness area. He also referred to the No More Clause in ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act of 1980.
It is clear in the law, nothing more than 5,000 acres can be withdrawn and put into wilderness without the okay of the Congress in Alaska. No More Clause. It stands for no more. Now we have a president that says, up yours to the Congress.
Young emphasized that last statement with a gesture, thumb to nose, fingers waggling. He sees this as another case of federal overreach.
And by the way, this was an example, I think, of this whole Department of Interior. Between EPA and Department of Interior, they're trying to cripple this nation, trying to cripple my state.
The president's defenders say he's not breaking the law because he's only asking Congress to declare the new wilderness areas. Congresswoman Betty McCollum, a Minnesota Democrat, stood to oppose Young's amendment on the House floor.
Now, I understand that there's differences of opinion how to manage this land, and that legislation designated in this area as wilderness may not get very far in this Congress. But I want to commend the president for his leadership on this issue, and I would hope that the legislative process could play out.
The House is expected to vote on the full bill this week. Whether it would change anything on the ground in the Arctic Refuge is unclear. The Fish and Wildlife Service says it's concerned about Young's amendment, but it hasn't done a thorough review. The service has repeatedly acknowledged it can't fully carry out its new comprehensive plan anyway unless Congress passes a bill declaring the new wilderness areas. The planning document itself says it would take an act of Congress to implement. And the Arctic Refuge manager has said he's still treating the areas in question as they've been treated since 1988, under a regime called minimal management. The differences between that and actual wilderness management are administrative and subtle. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
More than 300 wildfires are burning across Alaska right now, mostly in a wide swath of the interior and southwest part of the state. More than 3 million acres of the state have burned so far this summer, which is on pace to beat the record-setting 2004 season. Tim Mowry is a fire information spokesman with the State Division of Forestry. He says several fires that were quieting down roared to life again yesterday as temperatures reached into the 90s.
The Aggie Creek fire just north of Fairbanks, you could see a smoke column from Fairbanks coming up from that fire. The Fish Creek fire down on the Parks Highway, which was part of the Rex complex, was putting up a smoke column. The Long Lake fire down by Tok and Tetlin Hills fire down by Tok both became more active yesterday. And, you know, that required the Long Lake fire was one that was received 2 inches of rain last week. And yesterday it was back, you know, full of life, and we had to take drop retardant and water on that fire and bring in a crew to help try to get a handle on that and do some protection to keep the fire from advancing toward Northway. It's just a sign that of how dry things were and how quickly things can change.
Tim, which communities are dealing with heavy smoke? You mentioned smoke when I first got you on the phone. Tell us about how heavy it is and who's dealing with it. Which communities?
Well, I can tell you I'm in Fairbanks, and it's pretty socked in here. The smoke is probably, I think I saw something today where it's considered hazardous levels right now in Fairbanks. And there's a lot of smoke out in Tanana. There's smoke in McGrath. There's it sort of moves around depending on where the wind blows. And we've got west winds today, and it's blowing smoke, you know, from all those fires out in southwest Alaska, Tanana, and it's blowing it east, and so we're seeing that. And I talked to somebody at the border today, somebody at the Alcan border, and they were socked in with smoke. I would wager to say most of the interior communities are dealing with smoke today.
Is it expected to let up anytime soon?
Well, I'm not a meteorologist, but we do have a little bit of change in the weather going on right now. A cold front is moving down from the northeast and is going to bring cooler temperatures and much higher relative humidities throughout the interior. We are hoping to get a little precipitation out of this front that's moving in, but you know where that happens and how much falls is remains to be seen.
What's sort of the longer look at this? Do you think we're likely to continue on track for breaking the 2004 record for fires this year?
Oh, that's really hard to tell at this point, Lori. We are ahead of that pace right now, but I can tell you in July 2004, that was the big fire month. We burned, over 3.5 million acres, close to, 4 million acres that month. And so we've still got a lot of the month to go. These fires, I can tell you that these fires, we've got enough big fires now that it's going to take more than a little bit of rain to put these things out or to really even significantly impact them. I don't like to tell people it, but this is going to probably be a summer-long event, and we're going to be dealing with some of these fires, well into the summer, well into August. They don't just go away when we get some precipitation. Even after that, it takes work to make sure that they're not going to come back to life. And the way things are shaping up now, that may not be until, the snow flies.
Tim Mowry is a Fire Information Office spokesman with the State Division of Forestry. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Homer Police Department scrapes by and braces for more cuts.
I would say we're somewhere between desperate and just getting by.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
New Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz is outlining his priorities. Berkowitz recently told the Alaska Dispatch News that he'd like to funnel state funds tabbed for the Kinnickarm Crossing into Port of Anchorage upgrades. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Mayor Ethan Berkowitz elaborated on that idea, saying directing public funds to places it needs to go would make life easier for Alaskans.
Right now, the port modernization has a greater priority in my mind than a potential Kinnick crossing.
Berkowitz says that at this time of state fiscal stress, it makes sense to use available funds to the greatest advantage.
Ideally, in a fiscally responsible world where people were being careful with public monies, they wouldn't spend money unless they absolutely needed to. And the only project that I know of that's actually taking place on the Kinnick Arm right now is the Port of Anchorage. So if you want to spend money to help develop the Kinnick Arm in any way, the Port of Anchorage ought to be your first port of call.
He says the Kinnick Arm Bridge is speculative, while the port has proven economic benefit to the entire state. Berkowitz says he'll pursue state funds for the Port of Anchorage.
Absolutely. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure we get that port taken care of. Port modernization will save consumers across this state money on a regular basis because it's going to keep the cost of goods and services down. It's also an important strategic advantage that Anchorage has that has important application for our industry and for our military.
But getting the Kinnick Arm funds switched to the port may not be easy or even possible. According to Jeremy Woodrow, a spokesman for the State Department of Transportation, the $45.3 million approved by the state for Kinnick Bridge construction comes from a federal authorization receipt, or money that is a pre-authorization of federal funds.
It could be used if it moves forward with construction.
That money does not become real cash until construction begins. What's more, it comes from federal highway funds.
And that actually cannot be used for ports. So it's a different pot of money entirely. So for Kinnick Arm Crossing, the actual only money that could be used for the Port of Anchorage is the general fund amount, which is $5 million that's been designated toward Kinnick Arm Crossing to date.
Woodrow says the money in the state general fund would require legislative approval to be spent elsewhere. However, more federal highway funds are available for the Kinnick Bridge. $179.8 million as of January of this year. But Woodrow adds spending it requires legislative approval, and that may be a moot point since the Kinnick Crossing is still under an administrative order for review. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The state's dramatic loss in oil revenue means budget cuts to local municipalities across Alaska. And the city of Homer is no different. This fiscal year, Homer's jail will lose nearly half its state funding, and the city is also bracing for a loss in state funds that typically help balance its operating budget. KBBI's Quinton Chandler reports the cuts come at a time when the city's budget is already stretched thin.
The city of Homer holds a contract with the state to house prisoners arrested by the Alaska State Troopers outside city limits. The contract is still in place, but to save money, the state will stop paying about $350,000 to Homer, nearly 45% of the contract revenue.
I would say we're somewhere between desperate and just getting by.
Homer Police Chief Mark Robel has recently lost a full-time jail officer, leaving him with less than 24-hour coverage of the jail.
To compensate for that, we have dispatchers monitoring prisoners through a video surveillance link. And we have police officers going into the jail and performing jail officers' duties when they're not here.
The loss in funds is just another blow, and it makes the chances of hiring a new jailer bleaker. Robel has been expecting the cuts since February, but he says he wasn't aware they would run so deep until about a month ago.
It really makes a bad situation worse to some degree in the summer when we're stretched so thin on patrol with all the call volume that we have to deal with.
Robel will probably have to pull officers off patrol or have them work overtime to fill in as jailers. KBBI reported earlier this year the Homer Police Department was already stretched thin under perhaps the highest caseload per officer in the state. In a budget request for 2015, the department reported a caseload of about 570 cases per officer. Homer City Manager Katie Kester isn't sure if hiring more staff will be possible anytime soon. On top of the jail cuts this year, the city could lose another $320,000 in state funds called revenue sharing. Kester says the Homer City Council decided it would be unwise to rely on that money after the state warned it planned to take it away.
It was put into the general fund, so it basically was just used for balancing the budget and covering operating costs. That being said, council has said don't do that anymore because you have to consider it as one-time funding because of the uncertain nature of it.
This potential loss in revenue comes at a time when the city's budget is already vulnerable.
The city government is kind of been trimmed as close to the bone as it can be over the last few years since we lost the revenue from non-prepared food sales tax. So the city went through a big exercise in kind of cutting spending and becoming more efficient.
Kester says now, if it's going to save money, the city has to look at cutting services. Kester isn't optimistic the city's situation will change for the better in the near future, considering the state's fiscal environment. She says we're all in for some tight times. Chief Robel says he's just hoping for a new jail officer to take the strain off his department. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Seven whale-watching companies in Juneau are the first in the state to participate in a voluntary stewardship program that recognizes they go above and beyond federal and state viewing guidelines. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has brought the East Coast program, Whale Sense, to Alaska. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
It's a windy day at Stater Harbor in Juneau, where dolphin jet boat tours stage trips. A new orange Whale Sense flag adorns each vessel.
So that other boats on the water can see that we're a member of Whale Sense, and then they know that we're well-trained and carefully observing all the guidelines and protecting the whales.
Kathleen Turley is the port captain for Dolphin. She's been with the company for 12 years and does everything from maintain the boats to being a naturalist on board. Each tour begins with an educational whale sense talk.
We're informing the passengers about the stewardship aspect of the whales, that we're not just here to see the whales, we're here to protect them.
Federal regulations have a hard rule about keeping 100 yards between a vessel and a humpback whale. Beyond that distance, the rule is to be slow and safe. Whale sense is more specific and has a tiered set of speed guidelines that start 1 mile from a whale.
And basically it's what we do anyway, because you don't want to just roar up on a whale or leave rapidly, anything like that. I think it's helpful for new captains, especially that haven't been doing this for a long time.
Other guidelines include additional training and coordinating location and viewing times with other vessels. Whale sense participants go through onboard evaluations. In return, NOAA and Whale Sense advertise participating companies on their websites, and the companies know they're taking the extra step to be more responsible. For the most part, Susie Tierlink says the industry in Juneau does a good job of respecting the whales. Tierlink is a doctoral student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's been studying Juneau humpback whales and the whale watching industry.
Even though companies generally are following the regulations, because of the growth of the industry and the number of vessels on the water, there was just need for more.
Tierlink says in the early 1990s, there were no whale watching boats in Juneau. Now, she estimates there are about 35. She's heard operators complain of overcrowding. She calculates the industry in Juneau generates between $20 to $25 million a year. NOAA Fisheries marine mammal specialist Elyria Jensen coordinates Whale Sense Alaska. Worldwide, she says whale watching is a multi-billion dollar industry.
How are we going to make our little piece of that industry in Juneau sustainable? Because we're on the map as a whale watching destination. We're probably one of the top destinations, and it's thrilling that we can offer this experience to visitors, but we need to do it right, and we need to be really careful about how we behave around them.
Jensen doesn't see the growth of the whale watching industry plateauing anytime soon. She says the humpback whale population in the North Pacific is growing at a rate of 5 to 7% each year. And with more whales come more vessels to watch them. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
A B-25J Mitchell bomber left to rust in Nome is being stripped for parts and may one day be refurbished, thanks to efforts from a Michigan Warplanes Museum and students from the Bering Strait region help make it possible. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
It was a U.S. military bomber of the same class that went to Russia through the Lend-Lease program leading up to World War II. Planes of its kind later dropped bombs on Japan after Pearl Harbor, and it flew with the U.S. Army Air Force, the British Royal Air Force, and the Soviet Air Force.
We came up to Nome to recover a World War II B-25 that was sitting out in the tundra for the last 70 years.
Patrick Mahalik is the museum director for the Warbirds of Glory Museum in Brighton, Michigan, and he was in Nome last month to help salvage the historic plane.
The whole wreckage of the aircraft, we went through and we disassembled it. Many pieces that we need currently for the ongoing restoration, we shipped home. And then the rest of the aircraft, we package up in a shipping container. And hopefully within the next year, we'll be able to raise the money to have the shipping container shipped back to Michigan.
That ongoing restoration is of a different B-25, known as Sandbar Mitchell, another bomber during the war that went on to be a plane for pilots in training and eventually dumped water on Alaska wildfires around Fairbanks through the 1960s. Sandbar Mitchell crashed in 1969, and after 44 years rusting in a Tanana River sandbar, the museum recovered that plane, and Mahalik says they'll use parts of Nome's B-25 to once again get Sandbar Mitchell in the air.
We're going to continue. Our main project is to restore Sandbar Mitchell to flying status. There's a few parts from this one that are airworthy that we'll put in Sandbar Mitchell, and then vice versa, the parts that are not airworthy from Sandbar Mitchell because of damage, we'll put on the Nome one, so that way that one could be resemble a B-25 once again.
Just how that B-25 first came to the Seward Peninsula goes back to 1944. After being assembled in Kansas, the bomber was part of a group of planes allocated to Russia through Franklin Roosevelt's Lend-Lease program prior to World War II. The plane was officially handed over to Russian pilots in Fairbanks, who were set to fly to Nome and onward to the Russian front. But this B-25 never crossed the dateline. After a rough landing in Nome left it unflyable, and conditions in Nome left it unrepairable. But the Russian pilots of the Vienne Vazhdushne Silya, the Soviet Air Force, didn't let it go to waste. Here's museum trustee Todd Trainer.
It was not a complete B-25. You have to understand that the Russians stripped it of all the parts that they felt that they could use as repair parts or replacement parts in their other B-25s, and then it was just left there for vandals and scoundrels to come and take parts and shoot holes through it with guns.
In the 1980s, former State House Representative Richard Foster visited Skagway and told then-Skagway resident and aviation enthusiast Mitch Erickson about the bomber. Erickson moved to Nome in 1991, and less than a year later, he found the B-25, axed, chopped, and shot up over years of impromptu target practice. He got the plane loaded on a flatbed and hauled it away for safekeeping, but one wing, still bearing the Red Star of Soviet Russia, remained trapped in the mud.
We actually had the NACTEC kids there when they pulled the old wing out of the mud, and we had to have every hand available to flip that wing over. And there on the other side, you could see the Russian star still on there. Barely visible, but it was still there.
Nathan Pitt is the program coordinator for NACTEC. That's the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center in Nome. Recovering Nome's B-25 was built into NACTEC's aviation program this summer. And students from Nome and across the Bering Strait worked on the plane's recovery, applying that learning to NACTEC's own ongoing restoration of a different plane. Pitt says the coordination linked the historic B-25 to their hands-on work in the classroom.
The 1962 Piper Colt is NACTEC's project that we're restoring. So the kids were on that plane, putting rivets in, also taking rivets out, and then they went over to see the B-25 project where they were taking all the rivets out in order to disassemble the plane so they could see where this work was done, and they had a little bit of knowledge about the process and the parts that, you know, keep a plane together.
The Nome B-25 is now sitting in a connex in Nome's satellite field T-hangar, itself a Russian relic from World War II, not far from where the wing was dragged from the mud. Mihalik with the Warbirds Museum says the goal is to ultimately get the Nome bomber flying again. But the wing spars are corroded, and a, quote, substantial donation would be needed to make that happen. Failing that, he says, it will be reassembled as a static airplane, a distinctly Russian display piece for the Michigan Museum to help tell the unique story of the B-25. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. You can find our stories online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Quentin Chandler in Homer, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Matthew Smith in Nome. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.